The Guardian.
Scotland has, by majority, decided not, at this stage, to become an independent country. I accept that verdict of the people, and I call on all of Scotland to follow suit in accepting the democratic verdict of the people of Scotland. But I think all of us in this campaign will say that that 55%, that 1.6 million votes, is a substantial vote for Scottish independence and the future of this country.
Hello and welcome to this special Guardian podcast looking at Scotland's historic referendum result. I'm Jonathan Friedland, and over the next half hour we'll be discussing the constitutional implications of the result, what it means for Scotland and for the rest of the United Kingdom. We'll also ask where next for the Scottish independence movement and its figurehead, the First Minister, Alex Salmond. First, with the word from the ground, we can now speak to the Guardian editorial writer Tom Clark, who is in Edinburgh. Tom, a very long night for you, but just tell us, what's the mood there as these results now sink in?
Well, I don't know. I've seen a number of, I guess, fairly long or sombre faces on the street. I've seen almost as many journalists out asking people on the street what they think as I have ordinary citizens walking about, and I got stopped by another newspaper myself to ask me what I thought. I think that there would have been a very dramatic and visible mood on the street if it had been a yes vote, because it's been this great energy and great verve around the yes campaigners. The no side are what Alistair Darling calls the quiet majority, and I guess they're quietly satisfied.
Well, let's get into diving into these results themselves. What can you tell us about how the vote broke down across Scotland? Was there a geographical dimension to this?
Well, I think it's hard to say there's a very obvious geographical dimension. There was some things that long-term students of Scottish politics would have expected, like very strong no votes in the Scottish borders and in Orkney and Shetland, where there's a lot of hostility to nationalism. And beyond that, though, it's a bit hard to generalise. Places like Angus, which has had a Scottish Nationalist MP, returned a no majority. So the sort of more prosperous rural areas that used to be caricatured as kind of tartan Tories for returning SNP MPs sometimes, they often went no. And yes was a bit stronger in rundown places, almost took Inverclyde, did take Glasgow, and did take Dundee. So there is some variation, yes. But, you know, I think when the dust settles, what people might think is even more remarkable is the consistency of this yes vote, which, you know, now the yes side obviously disappointed because there'd been hype about whether they'd get up to 51% just in the last 2 weeks. But not in any constituency anywhere across the country did they get less than a third of the votes voting for outright nationalism. Now, you know, a few years ago, people would have said you'll never get more than a third of Scotland as a whole voting for separation. Well, they got up to pretty much 45%, and they got more than a third everywhere.
And what about turnout? There had been this extraordinary sight of people registering to vote, and this figure of 97% registered. People were indeed projecting a sky-high turnout. What happened in the end?
I think there's always a bit of a muddle between different things that you can measure. 97% of people were on the electoral roll, which was a lot, but there's always more people on the electoral roll than turn out. 84-85% is a terrific show of strength for any kind of democratic exercise, apart from if you had compulsory voting. It's you know, something we've not had in UK general elections, for example, since the 1950s. Compared with the 2010 general election here, I think most areas went up about 25 percentage points. You know, it's a huge increase, a really great chunk of the electorate that was disengaged, re-engaged, and that is a very positive thing, I think everyone would say. In terms of how it affected the result, It didn't have anything like the impact that the Yes side were hoping. They said there's all these disenfranchised people in Glasgow, in Dundee, who've not listened to or engaged with the politics that does nothing for them for the last few years. But in fact, what happened is that turnout went up from, say, 50% in those kind of places up to 75% or up towards 80%. But in places where more people were turning up before and turnout might have been 60%, then it went up to 85% or 90%. So the differential was still there. It's just that more people were voting everywhere and more people were voting on both sides.
Our thanks to Tom Clark in Edinburgh. And joining me to discuss the longer-term implications of the result, we have the man seen by many as the National Historian of Scotland, Sir Tom Devine, who spoke recently of his own move from no to yes. And from the No camp, another historian, also a novelist and journalist, Alan Massey. And along with them, Guardian columnists Polly Toynbee and Raphael Baer. Welcome to you all. Let's begin with you, Tom Devine. How will historians come to look back on this result and to explain it, do you think?
Well, obviously, there'll be two modes of analysis will take place, I think. One will be obviously why, given its apparent momentum, the Yes campaign failed. That's probably the premier question that my colleagues will ask in the future. But the second question is, in a sense, more intriguing, and that is, how did we get to this point? How did we get to the situation whereby in 2014, nearly half the Scottish population voted for independence? When, as late as the 1960s, as you say, the partly the catalyst of this process, the Scottish National Party, was still an irrelevant sect, and the union was at its high noon of sympathy among the Scottish people.
Could I go to your first question, just for a moment, which is about that initial momentum that it did seem, even 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, might carry Yes across the line. Again, taking a long view, as you would as a historian, what might explain why it didn't in the end cross that line?
I think there was a number of reasons. Although the anatomy of the result is still to take place, so I put that proviso in, is that a very large proportion of the no vote consisted of those aged above 55, and a very considerable social class proportion of the no vote were professional, middle-class business people. Now, if you take the first point, you've got to remember there, and I'm going down the long view rather than, the triggers for the failure, the short view. If you take the long view, then you've got to remember that age cohort grew to adulthood and beyond in the 1950s, 1960s, 70s, when Britishness was part of their way of life. I think, in addition to caution and the possibility of a great gamble, I think they had very great difficulty moving out of that mindset, of that set of attitudes, because we now know that the vast majority of those who were in the Yes movement, well beyond, by the way, the SNP, were in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. So there's been a very intriguing demographic or age differentiation in Scotland. And, of course, the Yes campaign will say, as almost inevitably, that their time will come again because they have the demographic edge.
Well, let's put some of that to Alan Massey. Before we do that, just a first sort of gut reaction from you, Alan Massey. I'm guessing you feel some relief.
Some relief. I mean, I think obviously Tom is right to a considerable extent about the age thing, although we haven't actually seen the breakdown of figures yet. But for me, the most interesting and impressive thing is the geographical split. That, in fact, only four council areas voted for independence. Two of them, of course, are very large, Dundee and Glasgow. Dundee by a considerable margin, Glasgow by a much smaller one. But the simple thing is, fact is, of course, that 28 of the council areas in Scotland voted for the union. And that makes it pretty clear that over most of Scotland, the vote for the union is very solid. It was, in many places, it was 2-1. And that's a very considerable margin. Let's just take Glasgow and Dundee out of the equation. which of course you can't. It would have been a sweeping victory for the No camp.
Let's just gauge some interaction from our columnist colleagues here in London. First of all, to you, Polly Toynbee, does this feel in some ways, even though you'd have voted no perhaps yourself, as some kind of anticlimax?
I think it feels like not the end of the story. I think Sir Tom is right. You know, you're going to have a cohort that will die out. You have young people who seem to be more in favour. 45% is an awful lot of people who voted for independence and didn't get what they want. I mean, how long before it all boils up again depends a bit how the English behave, whether they honour this pact, whether it's a decent deal, whether the English, you know, Tories don't rebel to such a degree that it gets watered down. I think the behaviour in the next couple of years will matter very much as to whether a whole lot of people say, we've been betrayed, or whether they say, well, actually, this was a pretty good deal.
And Raphael Baer, your instant feeling when you, I don't know whether you were up all night or whether you woke up to hear this news, but your instant reaction.
I sort of drifted in and out of consciousness following the results. I have to admit, although I would have voted no if I'd had a vote, there was a pang of, I'm not sure it'd be anticlimax or disappointment. I think there's the sense, I think I started to feel sympathy more with those people, perhaps on the left of politics, from the sort of on the progressive side of the Yes campaign, who, when challenged as to why they were sort of hitching themselves to what seemed to be a nationalist project, would say, well, actually, it's nothing to do with that. It is about, you know, we've wasted so much time sort of shackled to this dysfunctional polity, this state that simply doesn't work for us. This is our only chance to the kind of control alt delete and just restart with sort of tabula rasa to do politics our own way. And with this morning, witnessing already this very strong sense that the sort of centre of gravity in politics is already moving back to Westminster, and so much of the discussion from MPs is about what's going to happen to England and whether what rights English MPs will have as opposed to Scottish MPs. You know, everyone's, the lobby is already getting on the train from Edinburgh, you know, back to London. And there is, that gives me a slightly sinking feeling that already, although everyone says the status quo cannot be an option, actually the status quo very much will be an option.
Let's put that to you straight away, Sir Tom Devine. I'm very interested in that, this notion that people have said, as Raphael Baer just said, well, nothing can ever go back, this huge festival of democracy and engagement, as Alex Salmond called it, but actually things, it is quite easy for attention to wander elsewhere, and might the caravan move on, do you think?
Well, the basic foundation of that concern is that the Scottish people only make 8% of the British population. And I think it's almost inevitable that Westminster will take its eye off the ball. Of course, in the short run, there will be these discussions over extended devolution, etc. I think it's vital in those areas, by the way, that the welfare system is allocated to Holyrood. Otherwise, there's going to be a real storm of indignation. But if you go back again to the broader field, the broader point, your last speaker is absolutely right. 45% of a nation deciding to go down this line of independence is extraordinary. And that, of course, has happened not because of the popularity of the SNP or because of the popularity of nationalism. It's an aspirational dynamic. And it's a concern, a very deep concern, about the nature of governance in the United Kingdom and also the emerging cleavage in political culture between, if you like, the home counties and London, and most of Scotland. I actually would argue that what Salmond should have done when he was offered the two questions, this is with hindsight, of course, he should have gone for the status quo and extension of devolution, gained an 80% majority, bedded down the new powers, and then, after that period of several years, offered the Scottish people the choice through a referendum of independence. I always thought that this might be a bridge too far, but this movement is not going to go away because it's not a party political movement. It's a movement of the people, and especially a movement of that generation who in a few years' time will themselves be in their 40s, 50s, and 60s.
I think that's an absolutely crucial point about it not being party political. I mean, one of the lessons that I think a lot of people have learned from this process is that all sorts of assumptions we were making about who had loyalties to what and who could command loyalties have been broken. And you see that, as was mentioned, I think earlier, that there are relatively affluent SNP voters who have said no, and there are a lot of Labour voters who very enthusiastically have said yes. And whether it's a party allegiance or even an allegiance to this idea of Britishness that, as Tom said earlier, a certain generation feels very viscerally, and obviously a younger generation simply doesn't have that attachment to, we're really struggling to understand what it is that commands loyalty in politics anymore.
Alan Massey, do you share this sense, both Raphael Baer and Tom Devine implying there that, okay, independents may have lost out now, but just the demographics alone suggest it's coming?
I'm not at all sure about that. It may come. I think it depends what happens next. And I think there is an assurance of further powers for Scotland. I think what is necessary is a reconsideration of the political arrangements of the United Kingdom as a whole. And I think that it is essential that at some point, either probably within the next couple of years, that there is a constitutional convention to discuss the whole political framework of the United Kingdom.
But where, Polly Tommy, is the pressure for that? Now that the gun is no longer at the head of the party leaders in Westminster, isn't their usual default habit to just go back to muddling on? The pressure's gone now, surely.
The pressure is coming from behind Cameron in his own party. English votes for English laws took off within minutes of the first declaration. There they all were, the Redwoods, the Jenkins, all those people. And they're not going to let it go. And Cameron took it up himself in his speech. And that opens such a huge can of worms. We don't have a constitution. You pull on one little bit, other things come apart. So what happens, for instance, with lawmaking in the House of Lords? So you have this English Parliament that is passing laws only on health and education. Well, what about the House of Lords? Are they allowed to vote on everything English? Are they allowed to vote perhaps on Scottish laws too? Once you open this, you need a convention to look at everything. Should we look at proportional representation as a way of doing England better? There are so many questions here that the idea that it can all be stitched up in a hurry by November is daft. We could have a temporary solution in November, but there needs to be a proper convention after the election and people putting in their manifestos what they think some of the answers should be.
Tom Devine, I'm guessing there is no historical precedent for rewriting, in effect, a constitution in a matter of, 6 to 8 weeks, which is what this November deadline would imply.
Yeah, well, what they're intending to do is to look at a 300-plus Euro Union, which has been slightly amended by the development of the Scottish Parliament in the 1990s, as you say, virtually overnight. I think we're beginning almost to hear, as I speak from Glasgow down the line, I'm beginning to sense almost a consensus building up between at least several members of this panel. I entirely agree with Alan Massey about the fact for, and also Polly Toynbee, about the fact of the need for a full-scale, deliberative, careful look at the British state and its allocation of powers. In my view, and this is where I go into the territory I'm not supposed to have any expertise in, namely the future. In my view, the only thing that can prevent a further destabilisation of the Union, which might eventually cause the end of the Union, is to move towards a federal British state. This would not necessarily mean the four countries. It would mean that England would have to have, in such a conspectus, several more regional parliaments that it does not have at the moment. I would expect the centre of the new federal state, if it ever comes about, in my current imagination, to be in Carlisle, and the Westminster, the Palace of Westminster, to become, if you like, the Parliament of the London City State, or the London City Parliament. I cannot believe that the current Westminster elites, and I include Labour in this, have the gumption, that is the commitment, and the brains, and the quality of, if you like, statesmanship, to deliver that. And that's why I would love that to happen, because that will, if that did happen, then I can see long-term stability in our union.
So you're not the first to suggest that the knock-on effect of this Scottish vote may be to redraw the map constitutionally of the whole of the United Kingdom. But doesn't it, Raphael Baer, come up with this sticking point? Is the devolution next stage outside Scotland to England, as England, with an English parliament, whether in York or wherever? Or can it only work in a setup like ours, where one nation within these islands is so overwhelmingly dominant in terms of population, namely England? Can it only work if it is to regions? And Tom Devine there talking about various city regions, even London as a kind of city-state. In other words, does devolution have to be to the northeast and to Yorkshire and Cornwall and London rather than to England? And if it is, surely all these Tory MPs that Polly Tom has mentioned, they're all agitating for England as England.
Yeah, this is a debate that we're going to have a lot of in the next few months, precisely because you can't have a federation where one of the party, one of the members, as it were, is England, because it's just too big. It is completely asymmetric, and there's a lot of precedent from history to show that that sort of system, where you have the sort of the dominant big brother federal states with a load of younger brother federal states, is sort of less stable. The sort of the other problem, if you have devolution to regions, city states, Yorkshire, Cornwall. You still have differential levels of political identity and very differential levels of sort of economic capability. So then you get into a question of, well, what are the mechanisms for redistribution? Do we let bits of the UK sort of fend for themselves economically? Or what is the federal central power? And ultimately, Westminster London still becomes the sort of Washington villain figure in the piece that's constantly trying to redistribute. And that becomes very problematic.
If you listen to people, you know, beginning to push for some of the candidates who want to be the next mayor of London, pushing for London independence, that's something we should be really scared of, because redistribution is the nature of is the duty of the central state to make sure that there is even-handed distribution, which is part of the problem with the Barnett formula, of course.
Alan Massey, would there be any resentment in Scotland if the result of this huge movement and upheaval, a two-year campaign, will there be resentment in Scotland, I wonder, if the result of this huge two-year campaign in Scotland is actually then for the UK political classes to start obsessing about England?
Well, I think there'll be some resentment in some parts of Scotland anyway. But as I point out, and I do think this really has to be insisted on, that in the greater part of Scotland, the majority in favour of the union is substantial. I think anyone of sense recognises that any reconstruction of the United Kingdom has to be acceptable to the English electorate. I mean, it's nonsense to pretend otherwise. And so what we will probably move towards is a sort of very loose, quasi-federal state. I don't think we will become a fully-fledged one, but because that is a very complicated business, possibly even what we consider confederal rather than federal. But it has to be acceptable to the English, and it's absurd to pretend that it, for anyone in Scotland to pretend it mustn't be.
Tom Devine, let me ask if we can just broaden out from, if you like, these sort of constitutional questions, and something about the process itself, which perhaps everyone can agree on, which was this extraordinary level of participation, debates on every street corner, and a degree of interest and intensity that people hadn't seen before on these islands. Is that the kind of thing that can only be stirred by a question as deep and, if you like, existential as this? Or are there lessons to be learned here about how our democratic life can be renewed outside Scotland, within Scotland, or is this a one-off?
I think it could well be a one-off for reasons that you say. I hope it's not a one-off, by the way. Certainly in this country, if that degree of depth engagement has occurred, hopefully it will continue in this country. It will certainly not dissipate very quickly. But if you're talking about general elections and Scottish Parliament elections and that sort of thing, I cannot see that extent of engagement, because this was going to be a world changing event, if you like, a fundamental event in the history of the nation. And importantly, it wasn't about party politics. That's the big differentiation. It wasn't about party politics. It was about an enormous issue of principle and the future of the country.
And it's those enormous issues of principle.
Sorry?
I was just going to say, and it's those enormous issues of principle that motivate and agitate and
exactly.
disturb people.
It wasn't a bit, because as in the rest of the UK, there's a considerable disillusionment with the current political classes. And I don't think they could possibly have whipped up this degree of emotion, engagement and intensity of discussion, which I can tell you from my own family, is not a myth. This was a reality. And journalists from the world that I've spoken to during the last week to 2 weeks have been quite literally astonished about seeing this in an old historic nation trying to work out its future.
But Polly, it wasn't just that there was this positive engagement. There was a positive, if you like, or noticeable marked rejection of the traditional party politics. The party leaders themselves, the Westminster parties, seem to be despised almost.
Oh, that's not just Scottish. You find it now all over the British Isles. A real scratchy resentment against Westminster, anything that smells of Westminster. Any MPs who seem to be obeying their party whip, a fundamental breaking from the idea of what party is, both voters' loyalty to party, but also not much liking MPs being loyal to their parties either. I think we have to remember this is part of the danger of referendums and why government by referendums, which some people want lots more of them, is very risky, because you're asking people unrealistic questions, really. I mean, not in the sense of this one, it was a real one, but in an election, in a representative system, you have to choose somebody. And the reason people don't vote is they feel indignantly, I'm damned if I'm going to give any of these scoundrels my precious vote. It's much more that than apathy. And in a referendum, of course, you don't have to vote for anything, for anybody. You don't have to say, I admire or like Alex Salmond or Ed Miliband. You can vote for a thing, an abstract idea. Very exciting, but not real politics.
And yet, there could be a referendum coming again for the whole of the United Kingdom in just 3 years, this time about perhaps another existential question, our membership of the European Union. Once again, most of or some of those main parties will be joined shoulder to shoulder. Raphael Baer, what can we learn for a future referendum on Britain's EU membership from what we've just seen in Scotland?
Well, certainly having seen some of the difficulties that Better Together had making an emotional case for the union or presenting a kind of a patriotic version of the no answer on the basis of you know, all working together and dissolving borders, and this was a fabulous and romantic idea that could compete with the fabulous and romantic idea from the Yes campaign were putting forward. I am now deeply anxious about a sort of Yes to EU campaign. I personally support Britain's membership of the European Union, but I think a lot of the kinds of arguments that you would want to mobilise in favour of Britain's membership of the European Union, jobs, investments, better together, you know, we should all be all terribly collaborative, and isn't national identity all a bit obsolete and passé? These ideas were stress tested in the campaign, and although no ultimately won, Britishness is more resilient than Europeanness, let's be honest. And if you try and mobilise those kinds of arguments behind Britain's membership of the European Union, and it's the whole establishment doing it, and this anti-politics mood that's out there is still, you know, rife in the country, Yes to EU has really got a serious job on its hands.
I want to give the last words to our two Scottish voices, both of them people who look at the history of their nation. Let's start with you, Alan Massey. Will history look back on this event, September the 18th, 2014, as in a way a last hurrah for the union?
I'm not at all sure it will. I suspect it may look back on it as a last hurrah for nationalism. I think it may be the high peak of nationalism. It's difficult because a referendum simplifies everything, as Polly has said, and the way the question is put helps to determine the result. If, for instance, the question had been, should Scotland remain part of the United Kingdom, so that the Unionists were campaigning for a yes vote and the Nationalists for a no vote, I suspect the margin would have been wider.
And to you, Sir Tom Devine, will this moment be remembered as a high watermark of Scottish nationalism or something, or the beginning of a road to independence?
Yes, thank you for that question. I think we now obviously end the conversation, and certainly between the two Scots, with divided opinion. Alan Massey made a fundamental error by referring to this dynamic as nationalism. I'm not a nationalist. Many, many thousands of Scots who voted yes are not nationalists. This was a movement of the people for what they thought was the possibility of more control over their lives, on the one hand, and hopefully some reform, if it didn't, they didn't actually win, some reform in an increasingly less fit for purpose union. So I think the genie is out of the bottle in all sorts of ways. I mean, you talked about the European Union. Supposing there is a massive vote in England, which will obviously carry the day, against the European Union, once again, that's going to be one of the very vital variables in further destabilisation of the Treaty of Union of 1707.
Well, that's the deep historical perspective we were after. Thank you all. That's all we've got time for in this special referendum podcast. For more discussion and analysis from Scotland, download the Guardian Politics Weekly podcast, which comes online later today. My thanks to Alan Massey, Polly Toynbee, Raphael Bear, and we heard just there from Sir Tom Devine. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Our producers were Peter Sale and Jason Phipps. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.